ABBA was Swedish. The singing group? Yes? I don't like that.
Like to bring to order the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. I got an informational meeting today on two topics, and we're going to start as the agenda is posted with possessory liens and the transfer of vehicle title. I'm not going to give an introduction to the topic at this point. I think it'll become evident what we're talking about as we go on through the discussion. And after that, we'll be looking at how insurance coverage is handled on injury claims in some cases. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and have Pam Levitt. I got to open the informational hearing. And with that, I'll bring up Pam Levitt and Veronica Irvin and Steve Epling. Good afternoon. I know you're just thrilled to be here on a Friday afternoon.
Mr. Chair, that's what I was going to say, is happy to be here on a Friday afternoon.
Yeah, I knew it was having trouble fitting this into your schedule. So
now we're not going to believe anything else you say.
As long as you get me home by the Tiger football game tonight.
And you may park in my driveway.
No, I have parking already, Madam Chair. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt, representing the Northwest Credit Union Association. We have 1.4 million members in Oregon, and the Northwest Credit Union Association represents credit unions in both Oregon and Washington. We are here today to talk about an issue that has been discussed in the last few weeks, and Representative Holvey brought it to my attention, and On Point Community Credit Union has been talking about it, and it's an issue related to mechanical liens. I want to thank Representative Holvey for taking the leadership on this issue. And I just wanted to let you know, before I turn it over to the experts to give you the background, that we did survey our credit unions in Oregon and did get some really good feedback from credit unions throughout the states, many in your districts, on this issue happening at their credit unions also. So I'm going to turn it over to the representatives to give you the background on the issue.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and welcome to our committee. And if you just introduce yourself for the record before you start, please.
Great, will do. Thank you. My name is Veronica Irvin. I'm Vice President Compliance Director at On Point Community Credit Union, and we're located in Portland, Oregon. I'm just going to give some background on the issue to explain kind of what our understanding is and where we're coming from. So, as Pam mentioned, the mechanics liens that exist can be placed by entities such as mechanics and tow yards who provide services to consumers. And those consumers are oftentimes our members as a credit union. When they have a need to enforce a lien against that consumer for not paying for the services, they can place a lien against their vehicle. When they do that, the lien actually overrides a lender's lien on the vehicle. So being from the credit union side, that's where we kind of come into the picture. And that lien actually replaces it as opposed to just being added to it, and it allows the entity that placed the lien to take possession of the vehicle and actually sell it as collateral after a period of time. There are a couple of requirements to place these liens. One of them is to get authorization for the work that has that's being completed, and that would be from the consumer, who would be our member, and also to notify lien holders that the lien is going to be placed or enforced, because this would give the lien holder the opportunity to actually decide to pay for that service in order to keep their lien intact. So in our experience, the majority of the time, this is all handled, appropriately by businesses. It functions the way it should. But there are occasions when sort of the unscrupulous side of certain businesses where the notifications don't happen and the authorization may or may not happen. It's not clear. On Point sees this. About once a month, we'll identify that a vehicle has been retained by an entity and that a lien has been placed against it. We kind of find out indirectly, because what happens is our member oftentimes stops paying their loan payments, understandably, because they don't have the vehicle. And in talking with them, we'll find out, well, actually, here's what happened, is we had this work done, and then there was this lien that was placed for some amount that they feel is not reasonable and oftentimes is very inflated by, you know, extra fees or different things that that don't seem reasonable, and make it to the point where they can't pay for the amount, and they're not getting the value of that service either. So there are damages and losses to the member that can be, you know, kind of on average $5,000 to $10,000 in terms of the loss of their vehicle, any attorney fees that they may pick up if they decide to do any kind of pursuit of that issue. Depending on the length of time that the vehicle is being held by a party, the vehicle can lose value just from being, you know, not used, stored outside, or things of that nature. It can damage the consumer's credit because they have stopped making payment on a loan that they've committed to pay. And there's a lot of emotional distress on that consumer. They've, had a lot of confusing things happen to them by that point. Then switching over to the lender standpoint, from OnPoint standpoint, we also incur oftentimes $5,000 to $10,000 of expense on these kinds of situations. That can be in attorney fees, skip tracing fees, where we're trying to locate these vehicles, and then ultimately in charged off loans at some point. We also incur up to about 20 hours of work, you know, trying to locate them and trying to work with the members and trying to work with the businesses to make this all come together. So those are some of the costs that are very true costs that get incurred by both the consumer and the lender. Some discoveries that we have made throughout our process of dealing with these kinds of situations is that currently, the mechanics aren't required to demonstrate compliance with the requirements of authorization and the notification to the lien holders. If either an individual or a lender decides to challenge the business in court, they have to post a large bond, 2 times the amount of the mechanics' liens, which can be a large amount. And they also are going to incur about $5,000 of attorney costs in doing that. And in this particular case, the way this law is written, they don't recover those costs even if they were to win that lawsuit. So those are just going to be lost costs in doing so. So there's kind of a whole basket of knowledge and time and costs that make it challenging to try to deal with this from our standpoint currently. And so we're looking for a balanced solution that could help to mitigate some of those impacts both to the consumer, who would be our member, as well as the financial institutions involved. I'm going to ask Stephen Epling to describe a couple of detailed examples just to kind of walk through what this looks like when we see it.
Good afternoon and welcome, and nice to finally meet you after talking to you on the phone a couple times. And if you'd state your name for the record before you start, please.
You bet. Equally nice to meet you today. I'm Steve Epling with OnPoint Community Credit Union. I'm the Assistant Collections Manager there. As Veronica said, we encounter this probably once a month, we have quite a few more that are, of course, done correctly, that are the institutions abide by the law. We find this to be the exception, not the rule, as far as those institutions that don't abide by the law, don't follow proper procedures. But I do have a couple of examples of some of the more overt or people who are very brazen and open about their willingness to violate the law because there was no recourse. So one entity that we recently dealt with, they did not have a signature for any work. They actually had our vehicle since October of 2012. We got involved in spring of 2013, and went there to try to find out what was going on. Our member didn't understand why they wouldn't give the car back because no work had been done. When we got there, it was clear no work had been done. We asked for an invoice. They threw us out of their their shop quite by force. They refused the whole time to provide an invoice. We contacted the our attorney and the Department of Justice. Our attorney sent them a demand. They refused to answer. They didn't answer. They wouldn't answer calls or letters. The Department of Justice did the same thing. Forwarded our complaint on and asked them to answer the complaint. They did not. They also sent patrol cars by, which by then our vehicle was no longer on site. They had removed it and taken it somewhere else. So they never provided signature for work. The member let us know that he never authorized any work yet. The work he had authorized was for them to procure an engine for him, which they never did. They never sent any notice to any lien holders that they either had the vehicle or that they were enforcing a lien. When I spoke to the owner of the shop, he let me know very explicitly, I have the vehicle, there is nothing that you can do. This is after I had read the statute to him of what he was required to follow. He said, there's nothing you can do, I have the vehicle. So very much aware that the burden was going to be on us to try to, obviously their bond that they put up when they did the lien, we never learned about it. We didn't find out how much the lien was for. At one point the figure was $3,000, then it was $6,000, then it was $7,000, never with paperwork. So we would have had to fight this through typical means. We would have had to put up $14,000 bond plus about $5,000 attorney's fees. They have the title in their name now. This entity that never did any work on it made clear to us that they didn't have proof that they had done anything or followed any of the laws. They are now the legal owners of a $20,000 vehicle that belongs to our member. And our member is on the hook for a loan for that vehicle still. So that was one of our worst scenarios. We're still fighting through it with our attorney. So another entity, same thing, no signature for the work. There was verbal authorization to repair a water pump, but they inflated the invoice. We received it. The costs were just terribly inflated. There were costs for things. For example, she had paid them with a bounce check. They not only charged her a bounce check fee, but added onto the invoice the amount of the bounce check. So clearly, and their attorney did get involved, so we were able to adjust some of those things out. But they were charging us $7,000 is what they wanted for a $300 job plus $80 a day in storage for 6 months, when they never notified us and also never notified her that they were charging her storage. Which the law requires. For her to have fought to get her car back on her own, she would have had to have placed a bond of $14,000 cash of her own money, plus involve an attorney, and same thing would have been around $5,000. Just an insurmountable task for her to just have the right to have her day in court. So she asked for our help, didn't know what to do. We got involved. Through the small claims avenue, we helped get involved and helped her. We were able to recover the vehicle back for only $1,600 plus attorney's fees. So his $300 job, we still ended up having to pay out about $1,600, and we counted ourselves lucky to have gotten the vehicle back. It's about a $12,000 car.
What were the attorney's fees?
In that case, not too much, because we were very careful about it. There was that one was right around or under $500. So that one we kept very, very low because we used the small claims structure. But that was another one. And that one, thankfully, because they got their attorney involved and he recognized that they were in violation of the law, we technically won the right to pay them the maximum amount that they could possibly justify. After they'd withheld her vehicle from her for many, many months. So it's just very frustrating for both the member and us. And those are probably our, and I won't bring it up, but just yesterday we have another one, not even a mechanic, but he has the ability to place a lien, who threatened to use this system in order to extort our title from us. And I maybe shouldn't use a word that strong, but to try and get the title out of our name and into his, though he has no right to it. So in conclusion, when somebody has the ability to enforce mechanics liens, and they're not required to verify that they've done the work that they were supposed to or notify the lien holders as they were supposed to, it invites a lot of abuses. If the law says they need to do it, but there's no verification in place, people are going to eventually, unscrupulous types are going to eventually see that and exploit it. So while we feel that there's probably a lot of ways to find a good solution, and most importantly, a solution that doesn't hurt the good mechanics, tow yards, the ones that are honest and law-abiding, which are clearly the majority, it's important that that solution stop these unscrupulous types without hurting the good, honest, everyday people who are out there just trying to make a living. So a couple of solutions that we've talked about that we think would be helpful and hopefully not be a burden to law-abiding citizens is that we could resolve the inequities by having the people who enforce the mechanics liens provide proof either to the DMV or to somebody that they have received actual authorization for the work, and that they have sent notices to the lien holders, probably certified mail certificate of some kind. And then on top of that as well, because right now the law doesn't allow for the consumer, or in our case if we pursue it, the lien holder, to recover attorney's fees, if the consumer or a lien holder could recover those attorney's fees, that would help them to be able to actually have their day in court and find justice where maybe hasn't been possible in the past.
Thank you. Just one point. I know the answer, but I just, it hasn't been stated. These liens are filed with DMV, who are the ones that then subsequently issue a new title.
Yes.
Wanted to make sure everybody, it's probably pretty evident, but any questions? Not really a lot of questions. I think you've laid out the scenario and the problem very well, and it does seem like something that could use some attention, I think. So we'll hear from some others on it, and then we'll have some broader discussions with other stakeholders as well, and see if we can find a solution. I really appreciate you bringing this to my attention, and we'll see if we can find a solution. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
If I could get Amy Joyce and Lori Bauman up from the DMV, just to kind of run us a little bit through what. What DMV's role in this is, and what you are supposed to do by statute, what you're able to do, and just kind of describe the scenario.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, today representing the DMV, and with me is Lori Bowman, who is the Vehicle Programs Manager for DMV, who has the expertise on the matter. The credit union folks did a good job of describing sort of what the process is, notification to the owner, and then subsequently notification that there's going to be a foreclosure sale. And then the person who holds that vehicle can foreclose on the lien by selling the vehicle to a purchaser. The purchaser then takes that documentation to DMV and turns in a form that's been signed by the mechanic and turns that in with a fee and whatever other documents might be relevant, and can receive from that a title
to the vehicle?
DMV has received advice from DOJ that it has no authority to sort of look behind the transaction to ask for proof of documentation or proof that the value of the services is what was charged. The form that DMV uses is a certification where the mechanic in these cases would certify that the vehicle was sold at public auction after proper notification. And the certification includes a bold statement that falsely certifying to those things is a misdemeanor and what the various punishments are. In the world of DMV, we estimate about 9,000 of these transactions happen in a year, roughly. The vast majority of those are towers who tow abandoned vehicles, so not mechanics liens. But again, DMV doesn't have authority to look behind that transaction. That's the bulk of DMV's involvement. So if you have any questions about what we do or don't do or can.
So when you issue a new title, you're usually issuing that to another entity, not the mechanic and not the tower necessarily. You're issuing it to somebody who's purchasing it from the foreclosure sale that the mechanic or tower is running, I suppose, or putting the car up to sale through a foreclosure sale? Who operates the foreclosure sale?
The person, the lien claimant.
If you introduce yourself too, please.
Sorry. Lori Bowman, Oregon DMV. The lien claimant is the one that holds the foreclosure sale. The purchaser at that foreclosure sale is the title applicant at that point and is typically an innocent party, someone that paid good money for the car.
Okay. So I'm going to go back to the part that's confused me. So the person that's placed the lien cannot themselves acquire title to it. They can only sell it because of the lien, and then the person that buys it
is the title.
The title.
Okay.
So there's no way that the person that's done the work and is holding the vehicle, the lien, can get title to the vehicle.
Correct.
I see.
Unless they, my understanding is that they have to hold the auction sale, and if they're the highest bidder, then they can be the...
So they can bid at their own sale.
Okay.
So we got that cleared up. So the other piece of this is simply the process of DMV just administers the transaction in the process, and the lien is filed with you, and when you get a notice of the foreclosure sale or I guess a new applicant comes in with that documentation, then you just process the title to the new applicant.
Chair Holby, that's right.
And so you don't really have a legal team that investigates the whether the lien was valid, as in whether the notifications actually happened and things like that's not in your, statutory direction.
Correct. That's right.
Okay. Any other questions? This could be, one of though it may seem like a simple problem, I'm sure that it can be a really aggravating for people, and seems like there ought to be something we can do to help fix this so it doesn't hurt legitimate foreclosure sales and towers and mechanics who rightfully deserve their money if they do work on a vehicle, but at the same time, they need to be able to prove that, I would suppose. So I really appreciate your help and helping us understand what the law requires you to do and what the process is for DMV. I'm sure we'll be talking to you about this a little bit more.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I did have you know, the industry is here. I don't know if they wish to comment or speak. I'd offered, and it looks like somebody, Al's going to come up and talk to us, too. So,
excuse me, Mr. Chair, were you inviting me up or telling me to stay where I was seated?
No, that was an invitation. It may not have seemed like it, but it was an invitation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Al Elkins with the Oregon Tow Truck Association.
I wasn't sure whether you wanted to come up or say anything.
We're willing to help with this solution. So
great.
Find a solution. So whatever. It's a very complicated process, as you've heard, and we would be glad to work on it. As long as it doesn't make it more convoluted for us, we'll be happy to work on a solution. I need to say on the record, we've worked with DMV forever on this issue, and they have bent over backwards to help us with the lien processes. They put in extra fax machines. They've given us extra staff to work with. They couldn't do any more than we've asked. So we greatly appreciate their help in this. It's a very complex system, and one that we are diligently working with our folks and providing training quarterly, annually on lien processes, any changes in the laws, and what to do and what not to do. I have a person here that runs a lien service. The largest one in the state of Oregon, and she's here to answer any technical questions if you have any on the process. So that concludes my testimony.
Yeah, well, one question that occurred to me, and I probably should have asked of DMV, was, you know, the comments made by the credit union was that when the mechanic or tower puts a lien on an automobile, it not just goes into the first position, but it replaces the lender's lien completely. So the lender no longer has a lien on that automobile? Is that...
I'll ask Karen to come up and answer that question.
Great. That doesn't seem like it's what I'm familiar with in the real property
not
world.
Not what I'm familiar with either.
Where you have first lien, second liens, and they kind of go with the property. But right. In this particular instance, that's not the case.
Hi, my name is Karen Scardina, and my husband and I own Auto Lien Source. We do towing and mechanics liens for the state of Oregon. And I will have to say that, you know, the circumstances that the credit unions are dealing with are, like they said, not the norm. I mean, most mm-hmm. mechanics, most towers, I mean,
we believe that.
And like he said, I'd like to just reaffirm that DMV and us and the towing industry and everything, we all work together to try and make this process go as easy as possible. We have also been in the process of rewriting the liens to make them more conducive for everybody, because over the years things get tweaked, and so in that case it's good to, you know, get feedback like this, because then mm-hmm. we can implement those. And
so is it the case, as the credit unions have laid out for us, that in fact they lose in this process of a mechanic lien or a tower's lien, that the a lender that has a lien on an automobile actually loses that interest?
Yes, they do. Sometimes it's by choice, and sometimes it's just because the lien statute says that they do, but that's because they have to extinguish that interest to allow for another title to be issued. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can't give another title to the new owner while that one is still valid.
But do they get paid for that security interest that they have in the automobile before that happens?
Well, they have the choice of paying the bill and picking up the car. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. they have the choice.
If they're notified, right.
Yeah. So, you know, if they want to pick up the car and then do something else with it, you know, they still have the impending loan.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not in...
Okay, I got you now. All right. Any other questions? Thanks for coming up and giving us the
thank
tail
you for
end
the invite. Appreciate
tail end of the story. Daryl, you want anything to add to this, or I invited you too, but I didn't put your name on the agenda either.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Northwest Auto Dealers, the Northwest Auto Trades Association. I'll just be real brief. The examples that the credit unions offered are real, and they are examples of people who don't follow the rules. And I think if we try to find a solution by creating more rules, you'll end up with the same people not following those rules too. So perhaps the solution we search for are increasing the penalties for those people who don't follow the rules to create a larger disincentive for making money by not following the rules. Because if we add more rules to the people that are following the rules, we simply add cost to them without solving the problem for those people who don't follow the rules. So as we go through this process, and we're happy to join with you in that process, we think that perhaps the penalty phase as opposed to the paperwork phase might be the most appropriate way to find a solution to the problem.
We'll keep you in that conversation.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for your comments. So with that, I'm going to close. I guess I don't really need to close, but that's the end of the testimony on the possessory lien. And we're going to go into the next piece, which I don't think I'm going to try to explain at this point. This is an issue that has to do with workers and consumers being able to get treatment when they have insurance coverage, and the decision about whether it's a work-related injury is unknown at that point, and how that plays out in the system. So with that, I've got Randy Ritterbusch, Matt Orser, and Meta Hopper, and Janine Leiter, I believe. Leiter or Leiter. So I think I called up four people. And my assistant will bring up another chair.
Or they can wait.
Because Ralph would probably break it.
Ralph was going to introduce us, but I guess he's decided not to. I'm Randy Ritterbusch with Oregon Ask Me. I live here in Salem. I've been a longtime representative for AFSCME, and during that time I've had the privilege of working extensively with the Department of Corrections, the State Hospital, and a multitude of other local governmental agencies and other semi-quasi-governmental agencies. And recently I've taken over the representation and have the privilege of working with the state-operated group program here in the state, where this issue is even more prevalent. The more violent the workplace, the more injuries, the more this comes about. And this issue is around, as the chair indicated, what happens when you get hurt at work and the long process it takes for you to be approved, whether it be Safe or a different insurance carrier. What happens is you get hurt at work and you file a claim and they start the process. This process can take months between. I'm not here to bash anybody. We're only here to bring up the issue. So please, I hope that's not what it sounds like. Sometimes it takes months and months and months through independent examinations, through them going through their research. It feels like when you're going through this, these insurance companies say no, and then you have to go justify why. Whether that's true or not, that's how it feels to people. What happens is you file a claim. They're going through the process of finding out whether or not they'll approve it. You can't get medical attention because your private insurance company, PEB, in many cases, refuses to insure you because there's a workers' comp claim and they don't want to be on the hook for it. Well, that goes on long enough that these folks run out of FMLA leave. They lose their jobs because the employer won't cover them anymore because there's no reason to. And then the workers' comp may or may not approve their claim. By then, their injuries have gone on so long, they have not been able to seek medical attention, and it gets worse and worse and worse. And I have three people that work for SOCP or have worked for SOCP here with me today. But please make no mistakes. I could bring folks from the city of Salem, folks from the state hospital, folks from the prison system, from almost all entities around the state of Oregon that have this happen to them. With that, I'd like to introduce Matt Orser, who happens to be the president of the state-operated group programs, and he's going to tell you his story to start with.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. I got injured back in 2009. I got my L3, my L4, my L5 on my lower back, injured. Make a small or long story short, I guess, I had to go back to work. My FML exhausted out. My insurer didn't want to take on my case because it was a work-related, and they don't even know if they're going to get paid, so they really don't want to do any treatment, as that's what they say. I don't know how it all works, but they don't want to take it on because there's a work-related injury sitting out there on somebody's desks. I'm a single-income family. After everything was exhausted and I got my letter from HR saying, look, you either need to return back to work or pretty much leave our agency, I put 22 years in. This has been my life. This is how I put my kids through college. And for have them to come and say, if you don't go return back to work, well, I wasn't able to return back to work, but I had to be able. I had to go to my PCP and beg him, literally beg him in tears to get a letter to go back and explain to him, I can't afford to lose my job or I lose everything. That's my house. That's my kids' food. That's everything. And went back to work. Pretty much nothing else I could have done. I was stuck. Nowhere to go. Back to work. I'm currently still on, as a so-called pain management. I still take quite a bit of medication just to be upright and be sitting here in front of you today and to currently do my job. A little bit of enjoyment of life I got left, it's because of pain medications, which I shouldn't have to do. I mean, this should have been resolved. I should have had the surgery. We should have had this taken care of. I should have been back to 100%. And here I am today in front of you explaining to you I'm still it. I'm moving. I function. Pain scale on a daily basis, probably 7. And that's every day. That's 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And I just don't think it's fair that we don't have an outlet when we're hurt. And we go to a safe doctor, and the safe doctor pretty much looks at us and says, you're okay, it's just a sprain. There's no cause here. You know, didn't look at any x-rays, didn't do an MRI, didn't do anything. But yet that gets referred back to SAVE, and they say, well, there's nothing else we can do, blah, blah, blah. So that's why I'm here today, to explain my situation. I think there's some unfairness there.
The next person we have with us is Gina Leiter. Janine Leiter, sorry. And she is the chief, one of the chief stewards for the local, and she can describe many cases, but she's going to talk about two in particular for us right now and the effects that going through this process has on our members.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for listening to us. And as Randy said, you know, I'm the chief steward for the Southern Homes. There's 6 of them. And I live in Eugene, and I work as direct care in one of those homes. I have many individuals, but two that, like Randy said, I'm going to bring to you. One, she was off for a while. She did some modified work for a while, as long as the state would let her, and then she couldn't do modified anymore. And so she was basically based at home. Again, her time ran out. The amount of time that the state was going to let her be home was gone, and they told her so. We're not doing anything. We're not paying anything. It's the end. You have to come back to work. SAFE told her the same thing. We're not going to do anything more. But what SAFE did was said, we want you to come see our doctor. And she did. And basically they told her, well, you have arthritis in your neck, and we will certainly be noting that is could be an underlying cause, that you may have problems, and that we may not cover them. So the last time I talked to her neck still hurts. I'm encouraging her to go back to her doctor. She doesn't want to. She's afraid she'll lose her job. You know, well, you can't do it, so goodbye. SAFE won't do anything. So at that point I said, then just, you know, do as, you know, not as little as possible, but be careful. so that it doesn't, you know, make it even worse. And that's all she has. She would have had nothing. She's a widow. She lives at home by herself. And the state and SAFE just cut her off. That's it. No more. The second one, I happen to be very
before you
close
go,
to.
Before you go on, so you were saying the state, as in the PEB insurance?
The PEB insurance, correct.
Didn't cover?
She received a letter in September where PEB had told her on the 6th of September they were through paying for anything else. She was done. And she either had to come back to work.
Was it because it was a work-related injury or because they just didn't cover?
Well, it was work-related. She was hurt at work. She originally went out on the 5th of February. And they allow so many days for you to be on a modified. So between that, the 5th of February, and sometime in June, she was on modified. And then on the 6th, around the first part of September, when she got the letter saying, okay, then we're no longer paying your insurance, we're no longer covering this. On October, she told me the letter was dated October 10th. She had a letter from SAFE saying, we are no longer going to be paying for anything either.
Okay.
So it's return to work or find another job. Well, and again, as Matt said, she went to her doctor and she had basically told her doctor, oh, I'm fine. I need to go back to work now. You know, she just didn't have a choice. And, you know, like I said, their doctor said, we will add this to your file.
The pre-existing.
Pre-existing, exactly. So, and she's upset. You know, they're frightened. They don't want to make a claim because they're not, you know, if the state puts them off because they say they're hurt, then they're just out of luck. And when the insurance runs out or the FML runs out, and then, of course, if SAFE says sorry, they may or may not cover it. You know, it's like flipping a coin. Do I have a job? Do I say anything? Do I hurt? Do I? You know? And the next one is actually my own sister. And she was violently attacked on Graveyard. And she was kicked, which caused a huge hematoma in her leg that eventually erupted into an extreme infection. And she was out for, I would say, two months. But, and everything went fine. I mean, everybody did what they were supposed to do. She got well. She went back to work. But she got a letter from SAFE saying, we want you to go see our doctor now so that we can look for pre-existing problems. And so, of course, I don't know anybody that doesn't have something that's pre-existing, you know, whether you're diabetic or, you know, whatever. And she is. She has a rare disease called Ehlers-Danlos. But she goes to work just fine. She works just fine, you know. And if she gets hurt, then she should be covered by SAFE. It shouldn't have been said, we will now add this to your file as a pre-existing problem that might cause an injury to be worse than it should normally be worse.
So is what she's talking about is people that do make it through the system in some cases, and they're told at the end that now we know you have a pre-existing condition, and they aren't told that you're not going to get a claim accepted again, but the folks feel that way, and they're afraid to utilize the system. And this, the hoops that people are going through to get a workers' comp claim has changed our culture and our society when it comes to getting hurt at work. Used to be, when you get hurt at work, you were glad that you had workers' comp and you knew where you were going to get taken care of. There's a growing segment of society now that says, forget it, I'm going to claim it on my own insurance company because at least I'm going to get taken care of. And if I never mentioned to anybody I was hurt at work, at least I'm going to get the services. And this is what Janine was trying to point out. The next person I want to talk to is, this is the case that you really need to hear. This is what happens in the end. Meta Hopper had worked for the agency for a long time. She's no longer working for the agency because of this. And her story is the classic case that we need to pay attention to. And it's going to be hard on her to talk because her life has been so affected. So please bear with her.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Meta Hopper, and I work in Springfield. I used to work in Springfield House. On February 23rd of 2010, I was an 11-and-a-half-year employee with SOCP at the time. I was working my evening shift after working a day shift because we were short-staffed. The home I worked in is a duplex, as most of the SOCP homes are. I was working with a client on one side of the house when I was called to the other side of the house to help with a client who was highly aggressive. I was injured while placing this highly aggressive client in a noise-approved sitting wall restraint. The client's staff, who was also working in overtime, was holding her right arm while I was holding the client's left arm. The staff lost their hold, and the client was able to violently twist me from the waist up in an attempt to bite the other staff. I immediately felt a sharp pain in my lower back. I had to release the client from the hold, but continued to stay in the room with the client and the other staff while we tried to verbally de-escalate the client's behavior. I did not leave work immediately and seek medical attention as the staffing for that night was already below post. The next evening, I was examined by a physician as having a lower back strain. I was not given an X-ray or an MRI. His diagnosis was purely on my symptoms. Through the next year, I worked while experiencing progressive lower back pain and leg pain. Finally, when I was no longer able to perform my physical duties as required by SOCP, I went on intermittent FML from August 2010 to February 2011. On February 15th of 2011, I was placed on consistent FML. My doctor ordered an MRI, which indicated that I had ruptured the L5-S1 disc in my lower back. This disc had been previously injured in 1993 and had been covered by SAFE. I was contacted by a SAFE representative who suggested that I reopen my claim for the injury I received in February of 2010. I contacted a neurosurgeon's office but was told that they would not accept me as a patient until I contacted my health insurance provider to be sure that they would pay for the visits and the treatment by the neurosurgeon. Providence Health Insurance informed me that so long as my SAFE case was open, they would not pay for me to be treated by the neurosurgeon. My lawyer and I requested on numerous occasions, to have a written agreement with Providence that should I win my SAFE case, they would be reimbursed through the settlement. They prolonged this exchange until my insurance coverage through my employer ran out. I was unable to afford my COBRA and thus have been without health insurance since March 2012. In August of 2012, I settled my claim with SAFE, but the settlement did not include surgery. I was only given a monetary settlement. Therefore, I was forced to resign my position with SOCP and have lived on my small PERS disability payment since. I had to cash in my retirement in order to pay these medical bills, but that has since been exhausted. My only hope for surgery now is to be accepted through the Oregon Health Plan, and then hopefully find a neurosurgeon who will accept that insurance and allow me to have surgery so that I may return to the workforce. My ability to return to the workforce, however, is in doubt, as a surgery may be too late to correct the damage that has been done while I've waited surgery. Thank you.
Unfortunately, Meta is a member of a growing population in our state that fits this mold of unemployable workers. That it seems to me that if it's not illegal, it's at least immoral. I don't know whose fault it is. I'm not blaming people. I just know where she is in her life. And I know that at one point, when she got injured, there was two insurance companies fighting over who was going to pay her claim. I'm imploring you to take a look at this issue and figure out a way for these folks to get service. Because it seems to me that for an insurance company to save a few thousand dollars and to create somebody, a segment of society that now we all are going to have to pay their medical bills. And sure, we say the insurance companies are going to have to pay for it because they have to help pay for uninsured people. But in the end, who has to pay for that? It's you and me with our insurance rates that go up. It has to get passed on to the citizens of the state of Oregon. I can't imagine a worse situation than to be in. We have a segment of society that wants to go to work, but has been crippled by their dedication to their jobs and to the state of Oregon. We need to do something. And I look to the people that we elect to help us solve these issues. I'm not saying I have a perfect solution, but one of those two insurance companies should pay for it, and we can fight about who's responsible once SAFE makes the decision. But once you allow it to go past the point where nobody has insurance and you cut them off, we've crippled our society and we're just developing a burden that none of us need and a segment of depressed individuals that want to work and want to be productive and now feel less than people. And I really, really appreciate the time you've given us today. And Representative Holvey, thank you very much for listening to us and coming to our meetings.
So, any questions? No, I certainly, recognize that this is an issue, and I hope that we can find a better pathway than what everybody here has experienced. And I know that this problem exists outside of the public sector as well. I've been contacted by a couple people that have this problem in the construction industry, and have gone down this same road, so it's not just indicative of our state public employee system or the state of Oregon. It is systematic throughout all parts of our economy. So I appreciate your time and on a... you got a question?
Well, no, just comment.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I just want to thank you for coming and telling your story, and I know that I think I saw a couple of you at an event where I was the guinea pig. You got up and that Ralph set up, and that was on a different set of issues that you faced. So I really appreciate you bringing these to our attention, and just want to thank you for your really hard service dealing with the people that most of us don't want to deal with. Don't know how to deal with, so I really appreciate you bringing this to our attention.
Are you still going to come on tour with me?
Yes.
Thank you very much, and have a great afternoon. And to help us with this issue and maybe look for a solution, I'd like to call up John Schultz, Lisa Trussell, and Chris Davey. I don't know if y'all wanted to sit together or not, but there was three chairs.
It's been a long time since I've sat with these two.
John, would you like to go first, I suppose, get the agency perspective on this issue, and then we'll let Lisa and Chris, kind of give some comments, too, about what they think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to. I am John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I appreciate the invitation to be here today. I'm here to give you information about what we call interim medical benefits in workers' compensation. You're getting a flow chart that looks something like this that we prepared for you, and I'll comment directly to the flow chart here in a second. These benefits were created in 2001 as part of Senate Bill 485, and which was a negotiated package of reforms to the workers' compensation system. The benefits were intended to ensure that medical providers would get paid for some injured worker care prior to the acceptance of a workers' compensation claim. So looking at the flow chart, first, if a workers' compensation claim is filed, I wanted to note that the insurer or self-insured employer under the law has 60 days to accept or deny the workers' compensation claim. Currently, the typical decision process takes about 42 days for an accepted claim and 48 days for a denied claim. In 2011, which is the last year I have statistics for, over 94% of claims were accepted or denied timely. If the claim is denied within 14 days, starting to move down the flowchart here, if it's denied within 14 days, the workers' compensation insurer or self-insured employer does not have to pay for any medical benefits to the worker under the law. If the claim is accepted by the workers' compensation insurer or self-insured employer, they should pay for all medical services that are compensable or related to the worker's injury. If the workers' compensation insurer's decision takes longer than 14 days, and if the worker is not enrolled in a managed care organization, and the worker has a health benefit plan coverage, the following medical services are payable under the law from the date the employer's notice or knowledge of the worker's claim to the date the claim is decided, and that's whether it's accepted or denied. Diagnostic services, required to identify appropriate treatment or prevent disability. Medication required to alleviate pain. Services required to stabilize the worker's claim condition and to prevent further disability. If the claim is denied and the worker is not covered by a private health benefit plan, the worker is likely going to be liable for the payment of the medical expenses, not covered by the categories above. If the claim is denied and the worker is covered by a health benefit plan, the health benefit plan is responsible to be the first payer of the medical expenses according to the terms, benefits, and conditions of their plan. The workers' compensation insurer also would be responsible for any remaining balance on the provider's bills that are submitted before the claim was denied up to the limits of ORS Chapter 656, which is the workers' compensation statute. And I would just note that typically under our fee schedule in workers' compensation, we are typically a little bit higher allowance for payment than most health insurers. So it would be rather common that there would be a portion then that would fall under that portion of the law. After that, the medical provider, if the claim is denied by the workers' compensation carrier, then after that, after any interim medical benefits have been provided and paid, the medical provider should then bill the health insurer, who should process the claims in accordance with their normal terms, conditions, and limits on their policies. So we refer to these as interim medical benefits, and they are the specifics in the statute about the coverage is under Oregon Revised Statute 656-247. There is a separate process under ORS 656-313, subsection 4, to address payment for services after a claim is finally determined on an appeal of a denied claim or a settlement takes place. I don't have any data on how many workers are provided interim medical benefits. At the department, we do dispute resolution on medical services as a regular part of our program. We see very, very few disputes about interim medical benefits. We looked at the number of disputes from 2012, and they made up less than 1% of our medical disputes overall. And I'm not sure why that is, if people are just not bringing them forward, aware of it, or there's just not that many that come to us. I don't have an explanation for that, but we do see some disputes, not a lot. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Questions?
Well, that seems like a reasonable plan, but when you heard the testimony before and it went back and forth and it seemed to exceed that amount of time, and then all of a sudden, because she did have the private insurance through Providence, like what happened?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, I don't know personally. I would have to have knowledge of the specific claim, and I don't. So I am incapable of explaining that to you. At this point, I would just be guessing and speculating.
Do you hear many complaints about this issue?
Mr. Chair, it's not a frequent complaint or dispute that we hear. We do hear about this on a semi-regular basis. These issues do come to our attention. It's something we certainly tried to address about 12 years ago in the law as part of Senate Bill 485. So it was an issue then. We have heard about it occurring since then. When it's brought to our attention, we work with the insurers to ensure that the benefits that are supposed to be provided for under the law are provided.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's kind of hard to understand just the simple fact that somebody's got workers' comp and they've got a private health plan at the outset of this, and then after this process is done, they don't get treatment. That's the crux of the issue, and trying to understand, you know, what the intent of Senate Bill 485 was to solve that problem. And, you know, from what I'm hearing, that problem hasn't been solved, and I, you know, don't know if it's the ambiguity in the statute, and then the back and forth, and you know, it just seems like it sort of gets lost in the process somewhere. Just to comment, I guess. But maybe I'll turn it over to the industry and they can make their comments about it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Trussell with HealthNet Health Plan of Oregon. And we're a health insurer in Oregon. Listening to the testimony, I came in because I wasn't quite sure what the issue was, and I was part of Senate Bill 485 because in a prior life I meddled in workers' compensation, and then I decided to move on to something that was less controversial, and now I lobby in healthcare. however, and if I am correct on the situation that was described to us, the health benefits would have been through PEB, which it's my understanding Providence administers as a self-insured plan. So I'm not sure what PEB's benefit structure is. But as far as a carrier, we typically wouldn't know if it's workers' comp. If we get a bill, if our provider is billing us, we get a CPT code, they're not to bill us if it's workers' comp. So if they bill us, we most of our claims, I think that we're somewhere between 89 and 92% are auto adjudicated, which comes in, it gets paid, it goes out, and the member has paid their copay or their coinsurance when they got the service. And the one thing I wanted to ask before today's hearing, but then there was a little controversy around Cover Oregon and whether or not we were going to extend current benefits into 2014. So the people that I needed to answer that question have yet to get back to me. But I hope to find out in the next couple of weeks. It would be if it was a prior auth request that came in, prior request for prior authorization, for example, a surgery. Now, at that point, I'm pretty sure that we would probably know there's a workers' comp component. But again, it's my understanding that the worker would get the benefit, and then it's between the carriers after it's been adjudicated to straighten out who's going to be responsible paying. And it's also my recollection, and this goes back to 485, that until the workers' comp claim had been finally adjudicated, that the provider shouldn't have been billing the member. But it didn't sound like they were billing the member. It sounded more like PEB had declined the service. So I'm going to ask about the prior authorization piece if we would deny the claim or deny the prior auth, simply because it was workers' comp, or if we would allow the prior off with the understanding with the provider, you'll get paid once if we see if it's ours or theirs. Mm-hmm. So that's the big question, and I sent the email on Monday, and no one's answered.
Well, thanks. I appreciate you coming forward and giving us that. I don't know, maybe we'll listen to Chris first, and then we'll have some comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me, I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation, and thank you for calling me and talking about this situation and inviting me to come here and respond to this today. As you've heard, the people that testified before us are all State of Oregon employees. The State of Oregon's insurance coverage is with Safe, so these are all Safe claims. Have a great deal of respect for the people coming here to tell their stories. They certainly sound like difficult stories, and they do difficult work that none of us would want to do, so I appreciate their situation. But I have to say that this is not a complaint that we hear regularly, once in a while perhaps, but this is not something that we hear all the time, and their situation certainly isn't typical. John gave you some numbers about the speed in which claims are resolved. We have 60 days under the law to decide whether to accept or deny a claim. I think John said the average is about 42. We just looked at our Safe's average the other day, and we're averaging 29 days to make a decision to accept or deny a claim. So on average, it takes about a month to make that decision. It's not normally drawn out for a long period of time, but certainly there are outlier situations, and if it's a complex claim, it can take longer. But 60 days is the time that's allowed by law, and what is it, 94% of claims actually do get accepted or denied within that 60-day period. We also have, under the law, 45 days to pay a medical bill. I don't have a count of how many. It's hundreds of thousands of medical bills that we pay a year, and we average 18 days against the 45 days that we're allowed by law. So we try to expedite these things as quickly as we can. If the worker has workers' comp insurance, of course, and if they also have health insurance, there really isn't any reason why the provider wouldn't be providing medical services, because if it's not going to be one, it's going to be the other. I think you heard testimony that there are two companies that are fighting. There aren't two companies fighting where it's workers' comp or health insurance. If the claim is accepted, the workers' compensation insurer pays. If the claim is denied and found not to be compensable, then the health insurer will pay, obviously subject to whatever the terms of the health insurance are. And again, assuming that the health insurance is still in place, and I can certainly see some situations where perhaps if it's an old claim that's being reopened and that person is no longer employed by the state, there may not be underlying health insurance. But I think the way that we came in talking about this was where there might be health insurance and workers' comp at the same time. And so from the medical provider's perspective, they're going to get paid by one or the other. I don't know the stories that we heard from the previous witnesses here. I tried to find out some details before the hearing, but I wasn't successful in doing that. We would certainly be very happy to look at those individual cases, see if we can figure out what went on. These claims, as you heard, some of them are very complex, and the circumstances are difficult. We'd be very happy to look into those cases and try to figure out whether there is a crack that people have fallen through or some circumstance here that we can do a better job of dealing with, either within SAFE or under the law. And if there's a solution, we'd be happy to work with people in trying to find that.
Thank you. Questions?
So I have a question. The 60 days, it sounds like by law, that's what you have. And yet you said that 94% are decided within that 60-day period. So how is it that 6% are decided after? If it's actually by law, it has to be done by 60 days. What happens with the other 6%?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Kennedy Gaia, yes, the law says that there has to be a decision made within 60 days. There are some circumstances where the claim is so complex or it's so difficult to get information that you really can't make a decision on the 60th day. If the insurance company was faced with I have to decide today, then maybe that decision would be, well, I have to deny it, because once you accept a claim, it's almost impossible to reverse an acceptance. So if you really wanted to be right on the 60th day, you would have to deny the claim, and that wouldn't necessarily be in the worker's best interest. So there are very few claims that go beyond the 60 days just so that you can try to make the right decision. If we go over 60 days, if the claim is litigated and it goes to a hearing, an administrative law judge can find that that was an unreasonable delay, and we can be penalized for that. And also there are administrative penalties that the Workers' Comp Division could administer if there's a pattern of going over that 60 days.
So how many cases that are denied at 60 days then get appealed? And I mean, it sounds like sometimes you deny the cases just because you haven't made the determination, and you're, by law, you got to make that decision, so you go ahead and deny it, and then there's an appeal that happens, and then that takes another. And does that process also delay or stop the insurance carrier, the private medical health insurance, from covering the case while it's under appeal?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Well, Mr. Chair, we don't actually deny a claim because it's the 60th day. As I was explaining, if we get to the 60th day and we don't have all the information, we're going to keep investigating, so, and we keep paying the benefits until we make the decision. So we go over. If we were forced to actually do something on the 60th day, then we might have to deny the claim just to be able to make a decision at that point. We could voluntarily reverse that denial later, but it's better just to keep the clock running and to pay the benefits and make the right decision up front.
But let me ask this a different way. So given this scenario where a worker has workers' comp coverage, obviously, and also has a health plan, and the worker's hurt, and it's, you know, and it's a, the injury is a covered benefit under both plans, why don't the insurance go ahead and cover the treatment? Is that what happens? And then if it workers' comp decides it's covered by workers' comp, they pay for it. Or if they don't, you know, somebody gets reimbursed.
That, Mr. Chair, and members,
that what's supposed to happen?
Committee, that's how it's supposed to work. And the as I indicated before, most of our claims that come to us, we don't know if they're workers' comp or not, because a doctor bills us, uses a CPT code, and they've agreed not to bill us in our contracts for things that aren't under our benefit plan.
But a work-related injury is not under your benefit plan.
A workers' comp claim would be an excluded benefit. But the only time that I can see the question might come up, as I referenced earlier, would be during a prior auth. But it would seem to me, and I want to verify that my assumption is correct, they can go ahead and get the surgery. And we would not say, no, you can't have the surgery because we're waiting. I do not believe, and that's what I want to verify. My belief is that they go ahead and get it. There's a notation made. And then at the end, whoever's responsible will make the payment. The doctor, as I indicated, or the hospital, shouldn't be billing the individual in that circumstance because they know they're going to get paid. It's just a question under whose benefit structure.
I'll give John a chance here.
Sure. And my question is kind of a follow-up on his, so I'm trying to understand this, because first it sounds like what you've indicated is if they have both workers' comp and have a private health insurance, if they're injured, at that point they're going to be provided service, and they go to the doctors, and the doctors and people will provide the service, and you will, in the meantime, be working this out. So I'm going to go back to, so is the risk then, is it the doctors or is it somebody else? I'm trying to understand what would slow down the process of them receiving treatment during that time while we're still going through this process to decide who's paying. Because if you're saying you pay, if it's a covered, and I'm going to go back, if it's covered, I understand that, and then ultimately work that out, then what would slow down the timeliness of the treatment? Or, I mean, is there, I'm just confused at what goes on here, frankly, and I appreciate what you're telling me, but it's not making a lot of sense with what's happening.
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair and members of the committee, there are, for the most part, you make an appointment, you go to your doctor, and they send your carrier a bill. for the times where there's maybe a surgery or something that requires a prior authorization, then we have timelines, statutory timelines, in which we have to turn around a prior authorization. So I'm as perplexed as you as to why there would be a delay. The one thing, and I'm going to go way back to three careers, is that I'm not sure, but I used to work in an industry that was unionized, and the collective bargaining agreement covered things and timelines like for the Taft-Hartley Trust, which provided their benefit plans. So I don't know if it's something in the contract about how long they can be off work or and have benefits paid. But as we look into this issue, and I know that, Mr. Chair, you mentioned that someone in the construction industry, and what I would like to look at is, okay, let's see if it's not working, why isn't it working the way it was intended to? And is it something specific to trust? Is there, because I'm not an ERISA person. I sat on a Taft-Hartley Trust as a trustee one time, but I can't remember anything other than their rates were going up too. So, I mean, that would be what I would like to know, is if there's something in the way those are structured that would actually preclude the authorization going forward. And I don't know, but in a health plan with an insured commercial product, the care should be delivered. And then PNC carrier and the health carrier straighten it out in the end, like we do with a lot of coordination of benefit claims.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just respond to one of your earlier questions, that if the claim is denied by the workers' comp insurer, and if the worker appeals that denial, and there is health insurance, the health insurer is required to pay the medical provider while that claim is on appeal. And if the denial is affirmed, then obviously the health insurer continues to pay. If the workers' comp insurer is found to be responsible, then we repay the health insurer for what they've paid. And that's current law.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just to add to this, in discussions with providers over the years on claims where there is no health benefit plan, providers oftentimes will worry about taking the risk of providing a high-cost service and whether or not there's going to be reimbursement from the workers' compensation carrier or not. So to the degree that that might be playing out here, too, we could look at that. I don't know whether that is an issue or not. It could be. I have talked to several of the provider associations and provided education about this law over the years, but there may be providers who aren't distinguishing between those two issues. Now, moving forward with where we're going with the provision of health insurance in this state and across the nation, that I would hope that issue would disappear for us.
Mr. Chair, one more thing just popped into my mind, and you guys are all kind of blurry because I had my eyes dilated today, so I apologize if my eyes look funny. But another thing that could be an issue is as they even with a private insurance company or with a self-insured trust, is not so much of will the company pay for it, is the individual eligible? Premiums paid, they're at work, whatever the eligibility requirements are for the different. And that I could see if there was some perception perhaps of a gap in the coverage. But other than that, I'm having a hard time, and that's why I was wondering if it wasn't maybe something novel about the structure of PET.
All right. I appreciate that. I don't know for certain either that answer that question. I don't think that there's anything peculiar to ERISA Taft-Hartley plans that would cause this disconnect, but I don't know for sure.
Well, I was just going to say that what we talked about, what we think this intends, where the person gets the care they need and within 60 days it's figured out who pays for it, seems very reasonable. But when I look at the three bullets down there, it looks like there might be one missing, because this says that in that interim period before the decision is made, diagnostic services are covered, medication to alleviate pain, and services to stabilize the condition and prevent further disability, but that leaves out actually treatment to improve.
Yeah.
So the surgery. And I think that's what got delayed. And then if on top of that we go beyond the 60 days, and then if the person, you know, maybe it goes beyond the 3 months of FEMLA because they've been taking care of a sick relative and already used up a month of that or so, then they lose their job. I mean, you can see how it happens. So it seems like even in this law itself, there seems to be a fourth bullet missing.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think you're right about that, but that's kind of what we're talking about here, perhaps. But any other questions for this particular panel? I know the insurance division is in the room to answer questions, and you know, John, I'd like to go ahead and excuse Chris and Lisa and have the insurance division come up. And you can stay there, John, because I think I have a question that is pertinent to both the insurance division and it's purely, you know, I think I sort of asked you, do you hear about these sorts of complaints? And I'm kind of curious about, from the insurance division, they have an ombudsman that hears issues, and I'm kind of curious what the insurance division hears about this particular issue when somebody has insurance and has workers' comp and, you know, treatment is not forthcoming, and down the road, and then they never do get the treatment, evidently. So I'm just kind of curious. If you'd introduce yourself for the record anyway,
certainly.
Please.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jeanette Holman. I'm a senior policy analyst at the insurance division. And also with me is Gil Gage, who is also a senior policy analyst. And she actually is a former consumer advocate in our agency as well, so she actually worked in that area. One thing I will mention before we get started is that, or before I turn it over to Gil to talk about consumer advocacy, we don't have any control over what PEB does. They are not regulated by us. We sometimes answer or try to help people who have PEB claims, but we don't really have any authority to make PEB do whatever.
And is that because they're a self-insured plan?
It's statutory. It's more. It's just the way the statutes are set up that
mm-hmm.
they're totally exempt from regulation under the insurance code.
They're exempt from the Insurance Practices Act?
Yes, indeed. So I'm going to let Gail talk to you more about kinds of complaints they might have gotten.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, thank you for having us up here. My name is Gail Gage. I'm a senior policy analyst. As Jeanette indicated, I spent the last 4 years as a consumer advocate. And honestly, a lot of these claims, if it was related to workers' comp, we sent them downstairs to the ombudsman on behalf of the workers' comp division. But I will also say that for the 20 years before I became a consumer advocate, I was a workers' comp attorney, 10 years for injured workers, 10 years for insurance companies. And yet this was a serious problem when I was especially representing injured workers, trying to sort out who's going to pay for these treatments. And another, and one of the things that caught my attention as I was listening was that one of our consumer representatives here talked about settling the claim. And so having heard that, there's so many variables, it's hard to understand what may have gone south in her claim. My sympathy certainly is with her in a difficult situation. But I also think that you made a very helpful observation, you know, Representative Kenny Geyer, about the bullet point missing. There's no restorative treatment. As this is pending, then you settle the claim, and then the person oftentimes doesn't get enough in the settlement to actually cover the surgery that they need to get. It is a serious problem.
Any other
comments, questions? I appreciate you being here and helping us sort through this, because I had recognized that that bullet point was missing in the statute. And, you know, I haven't gone back and looked at Senate Bill 485 in depth and looked at the record in that, but it's my understanding that, and maybe Lisa can verify this, though, that the intent was that when somebody has health insurance and workers' comp, that the person would be able to get treatment. And then they would hash out who pays for it at the end of the day. But the way the statute's written and the way this bullet point is presented, that's not how it works. And so the person doesn't get treatment. They go through this process, and with that bullet point missing, it becomes a very ambiguous and perhaps subjective decision on whether somebody's covered or not covered and by who. And then they fall through the cracks. I mean, that's what it appears to me. So, you know, I'm hopeful that we'll be able to dissect that a little bit more and figure out, if we make a change to this, what kind of impacts it has both to the workers' comp carrier and to the insurance carriers. But it certainly seems like if somebody's got that kind of coverage, they ought to be getting the treatment. And if they don't, they're not getting what they paid for. And that is a consumer issue to me.
Well, I have a question about PEB
that we need to solve.
If you guys don't regulate PEB, if there's an issue with them, where's the enforcement on the Public Employee Benefit Board?
It's with PEB.
So, in other words, if I've been denied something and where in maybe a private sector, I would have gone to the insurance division. Do I go to the PEB board? Is there any court action? I mean, if you guys don't regulate PEB...
Who does?
Yeah, who does?
You do.
We would only regulate to the extent that they have a third-party administrator administering for them. But when it comes down to whether something is covered or within the PEB plan, we don't have any say.
Okay, it would be their board that would have
it. Would be their
okay.
board.
And that is true with all, I think, self-administered health plans.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah, they're all exempt from us.
They're all exempt from
We do get a lot of calls from public employees, and I believe we try to help them, but we don't have a hammer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
John, I had a question for you, but it escapes me now. It probably had something to do with you know, ombudsman aspect of this, and, you know, I know your division's pretty active in working with our carriers, and I know our carriers generally try to do a good job with this, but has there been discussion about trying to rearrange this flowchart to address this particular issue, or has it just been something that's been off the radar screen?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would say it's no, there really hasn't been a lot of discussion about addressing this, not since 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Before that time, there wasn't this law at all, and that was changed as part of Senate Bill 485, as you noted, and I do believe you characterized the public policy goal absolutely correctly, to try to get treatment to workers in this interim period, so get the treatment they need, get them at least stabilized, understand what their conditions were, and hopefully get people back into the workforce as quickly as possible. And it was a recognition on all sides that nobody benefits by delaying that treatment.
It seems like it costs everybody more.
Right. And so I think that as we've evolved, the entire, and I use the term sports medicine model, has become more of the model. Return to work, I think, is seen more of, as a part of the treatment plan rather than we're going to wait until everything is done and then talk about return to work. But that's not what happened in the examples that the employees brought forward. And I don't think you'd find an argument from anyone that those outcomes are good outcomes. They're not.
Right.
Those aren't the outcomes we would want. Anybody would want. I think I'm safe in saying that.
And in the insurance ombudsman, you know, we talk about PEB. But as you hear these similar issues, I got to believe that you've heard this same sort of complaint or people falling through the cracks in the insurance world that you do regulate as well in the private insurance industry. I mean, it's not just peculiar to PEB is what I'm getting at. Have you heard of this complaint in other venues?
Yeah, this is not new.
Okay. I guess that sort of answers my question. Gosh, I'm running out of things to say, and it's Friday afternoon. And
I have a question for you.
Oh!
Do we have committee bills already assigned? I know I was trying so hard not to ask questions. But
that's not part of this informational hearing.
I'm curious.
Do we have committee bills?
Do you already have three committee bills designated? You're working on
that? I have probably seven or eight committee bills for the three slots, and I haven't actually picked which one. And I was going, you know, I surveyed the committee early on, you know, if they had input into what they would like to have as committee bills, and I didn't get a lot of response.
Well, now I have more response.
Okay, well, we'll talk after the hearing instead of in this public informational hearing about that. I guess I can't drag anybody else up here to talk about this. I think I've heard.
Do you want to, Representative Holvey?
No.
You want us to keep going?
No. I think I've heard enough this issue. I think that I would like to seek a more streamlined or perhaps a slightly different process in this particular issue to solve this particular problem. And I'm hoping I can do that without negative impacts to any entity, but you know, that's probably a Christmas wish that I won't get because I probably haven't been good enough to get to avert coal in my stocking.
So, Chair Holvey, I would love to have an informational hearing maybe in late February about the whole question of self-insurance mm-hmm. and regulation of that.
That's a much bigger issue.
It's a much bigger issue, but now that you put that on my radar, you know, my antenna's
up. I've run across that before. You know, I'm with a self-insured plan, and I was having problems, and I found out the insurance division really couldn't help me.
Yeah, there's a lot of huge benefits to self-insurance, but just want to make sure there's the protection, too.
All the same, I appreciate your time on this Friday afternoon because I really know that you wanted to get out of the office early. So I could have kept you till 5, but I think I'd have a revolt. So thank you very much appreciate everybody coming today and sharing their issues with us. I think we heard two issues that are kind of technical and maybe seem like small tweaks, but I'm sure are more complex than I think they are. So with that, I'm going to close the informational meeting. And we will adjourn the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection, Government Efficiency. Protection, Government Efficiency.